Welcome to the State of the Nation.
Your guide to student and UK politics.
This
is URN.
Very special big picture podcast, The State of the Nation. We've already had one. This is our December issue on the environment, and we have our very esteemed panel before us. We have...
Hi, I'm Jacob Collier. I'm the chair of Labour Students.
Hello, I'm Richard Meredith. I am the president of Nottingham University Conservative Association.
I'm Callum Southern, and I'm the chair of the University of Nottingham Liberal Democrats.
Super stuff. Well, thanks ever so much for coming along. As I say, our topic today is on the environment, and we're going to start off with a fairly contentious issue over the past few years. So our question regards fracking, and it is, what is the panel's attitude towards fracking? How should the government balance extensive investment opportunities with supposed environmental damage? Who wants to start us off?
Go on, I'll start. I'm sceptical. I don't follow party policy on this issue, to be honest. I don't agree with it. I think it's one of those things that we should change by a vote at conference. And however, research does also show it does have its problems, so I can understand why people are sceptical. I mean, research suggests that hydraulic fracking wells have an adverse effect on agricultural productivity and in the vicinity of wells. And one paper found that productivity of an irrigated crop decreases by 5% when a well is drilled during the agriculturally active months within 11 to 20 kilometre radius of a producing township. So you can see the kind of problems that might have on agriculture within an area. So we do have to take that into consideration. And when we've seen problems with fracking in the past, so in places like Pennsylvania where water supplies have been contaminated in areas where large-scale fracking has been taking place, I think we do need to have a level of scepticism. But there are also economic benefits to it that, you know, institutions like the Brookings Institute, for example, have pointed out on numerous occasions. And we need to find a balance of having the right regulation in place, but at the same time, if the idea is good for us as a nation economically but doesn't damage the environment to the levels that we've perhaps seen in Pennsylvania, it's something I think we need to consider.
Right.
Well, my view is I think that we should ban it completely, because I think it locks us into a cycle of non-renewable energy. When we need to move towards clean energy, we need to move towards renewable energy. As Callum's already said, it's potentially dangerous, not only for the environment, but also that actually the process involves sort of blasting quite a lot of water down a shaft. And of course, first of all, you have to transport that water, and then there's problems with the chemicals that are involved, which can contaminate the water supply, which is what we've seen in America. And of course, there is also the potential for oil spills with these rigs as well. So we shouldn't be locking ourselves into energy sources that are not sustainable for the future, and we have to look towards clean energy like renewables, solar panels, wind power and things like this.
Both of you sort of very correct in what you're saying, but I'd like to just highlight a few points. You talked about farming and the effects that it could have on agriculture. Mm-hmm. Well, every energy source has negative environmental impacts. Whether it's solar panels, you have to take all that farming land, all that land away, whether it's wind turbines and the effects on birds or the building of them, they're always negative impacts.
To be fair, that the effect to birds is quite negligible. Very few birds actually get caught up in wind turbines, and there's a large body of evidence to show this as well.
Yeah, there's always a negative environmental impact when
to some degree, yeah.
But what we have to sort of, I think, realise is that there are 1,300 trillion tons trillion cubic feet of shale gas under the UK. 10% of this supply would satisfy the UK's energy needs for 50 years. And so I'm not saying that we should, suggesting that we need to turn over into shale gas or go over to fracking, but we are not at the point where renewable resources can provide 100% of the UK's energy capacity. We need to, for the meantime, have some fossil fuels in our energy production. We are phasing them out, they need to be phased out, but it surely is better to use fossil fuels that are homegrown, independent of other countries, in a way, so we're not reliant on other people.
Well, I mean, is it completely independent? Because you have foreign companies that come in and actually extract that, so it's not British companies that are doing it.
But it could be. I mean, in this case, perhaps it is not. I can't tell the origin of all the companies. But it could be British companies. And the point of it, if it's being extracted on British soil, then there'll probably be a huge range of benefits of Britain, as we said, economically, on the price of that energy.
Well, I think this comes to a wider point of that as a country, we're not actually investing in clean energy, in energy production. So you mentioned about how solar panels take up space and things like that. Well, they can be quite easily fitted to houses already. We can have a requirement where new builds, public buildings have solar panels on them, and that would not be an adverse impact to the environment.
No, not at all. I mean, I think it's not to say that this can replace renewable energies, but if we are going to have part of our energy supply created by fossils, which we just practically have to for the meantime, surely it's better to do it where we're not reliant on other countries to produce that energy for us. If we're not reliant on Russia or Saudi Arabia for their oil, Russia for the gas. Surely it's better to do it on our own shores.
On that point, I'd like to ask two questions before we wrap up. One is on the suggestion that this would be a means to an energy supply before we rolled out renewables fully. I mean, the amount of infrastructure that would be required in terms of pipeline, in terms of trucks and infrastructure, is there not a reasonable suggestion that once all of this is in place, you're sort of trapped fracking, if you like, and that you therefore could roll out renewables, but given that you've put all of the infrastructure in, all of the pipelines, all of the networks and all the rest, and you've got big drilling companies in, would any government not therefore be sort of compelled to keep on fracking even if you've rolled out renewables?
I think it's heavily dependent on the government of the day. I mean, we had a huge infrastructure in our coal mines and they were still now seen economically environmentally not fitting and are being closed. Just because the infrastructure is there doesn't mean that we have to keep using it. We are still an independent country, and just because a business has invested into a part of our economy doesn't mean we have to keep that part of the economy alive no matter what.
Right, and final question, I mean, particularly to the two people on the panel who are more in favour of this, let's say, I mean, how would you balance the national interest, as it were, in terms of fracking, in terms of energy security and all the rest, against local demands? So obviously there was the issue, I think it was in 2014 near Blackpool, of a very large, substantial fracking supply, and people were very nervous about it, and Lancashire County Council basically stopped the entire thing despite the demands of the government. How would you balance those two aspects, the local and the national?
I mean, this is the problem, though. This is why I'm not saying I'm in favour of it. I will make that clear. I just think we need to take an open mind on the issue rather than outright saying no, that's a terrible idea. The thing is, if local people don't want it and the campaign is big enough and public pressure is big enough, politicians will ultimately wield if they think they're going to lose votes. That's the way the system works, and especially local councils. You can imagine the tensions that would come about from local councils and the government, although the government clearly doesn't listen to local councils anyway. But this is why we need to be careful. We need to have loads of public consultations if it is rolled out. I personally think we shouldn't be too strident in the way we roll it out if we choose to. But I'd much rather we invested in renewable energy for the long term than then end up going into fracking. I mean, yes, it has its benefits. Yes, there are there's things you can get out of it, but it's such a slippery slope, because once you go down that path, are you going to be able to roll it back? And it's all right saying, well, we closed the coal mines, yeah, but look how bad the coal mines actually got before we did close them, before we really started closing them down. And I mean, I come from a coal mining family, so I know what that situation's like. Governments don't like to sack people. And
it's talking about different scales. Coal mines had been there for probably hundred or so years.
They were part of the cultural,
part of the community. That's not going to happen the same way with fracking. It's more of a short-term solution until the renewable technology gets to a point where we can become 100% dependent on it. As for the question about local councils, obviously local councils have that power and they have every right to use it if the people there decide that they don't want fracking to go on in their area. What the government should do and can do, and also experts in the field and the companies in the field, need to make the case of why this needs to happen or why we should be doing this in the UK. And that is basically, you've got to make that point, this is a way of having energy, or a gateway to have energy independence, until we get to the point where we can be completely dependent on renewable energy.
Well, this is the whole problem, isn't it? This kind of idea of not in my backyard, you know, that sort of argument that comes across. Whereas if you've got solar panels that are actually on people's homes, they get a benefit from that, because eventually there will come a time when they can benefit from that energy source directly, instead of fracking, where it will go to another company and they perhaps won't have that energy, but they still have to have the effects of it in terms of, you know, having to look at the rig every day when they open their curtains.
This is about convincing the public, isn't it, and ultimately winning the argument. It's
right. Thank you very much indeed. A very interesting discussion. I'm sure there'll be further news about such issues in the future. But we're going to move on to a topic that hasn't been discussed all that much in recent years, which is Brexit, of course. And a very simple question regarding Brexit and agriculture, because, of course, as with a lot of issues, agriculture and farming and the fishing industry have all been wrapped up within European issues since we've been a part of the European Union. So the question really is, what impact does the panel think Brexit will have on rural affairs? How, for instance, will farmers operate or benefit outside of the common agricultural policy? Who wants to start us off, Jacob?
Well, of course, yeah, we saw last week the Brexit Secretary, David Davis, go to Parliament and essentially admit that he hadn't done his homework. The government hasn't completed any impact assessments on how Brexit's going to impact various sectors of the British economy. I understand that the common agricultural policy is in place until about 2022. We've committed to that, I believe. And of course, there's the huge issue of, well, if the agricultural industry collapses, it's going to have a knock-on impact on the food industry, on the drink industry as well, on local businesses that rely on farming for their produce.
Do you foresee the agricultural industry collapsing as a result of our departure from the European Union?
Well, it depends, really. If we have this kind of cliff-edge approach, which some Conservatives have kind of toyed with, obviously there's going to be a cut in the subsidy, and there's questions over if farmers rely on migrant labour, for example, where is that going to come from? What is the impact of our deal that we're going to have with the EU? What is that going to have on their farms? Because, you know, obviously the higher costs that they have, that's going to relate back to customers and, you know, could be quite problematic for them.
When payments through the CAP, DEFRA have actually done a study on this, and they've said that they think around 55% of farm incomes in 2014 was as a result of the CAP. The question I'd really like to ask is, where's the money coming from when we've still got a huge deficit? That deficit's not being cut Indeed. Anytime soon as a result of Brexit. And every time that somebody suggests, well, let's raise taxes, there's outcry on the issue. We keep saying, oh, well, we're going to fund this, the British government will be able to fund this after 2022, but where's the money coming from? And, you know, I'm not saying this as somebody that doesn't like spending. I do like spending. You should like spending.
Especially at Christmas.
Oh, we all love spending at Christmas, but where's the money coming from? Because nobody seems to know where the money's coming from, and David Davis's inability to actually do his homework, I think, is representative of what the government's like at the moment, and quite personally I think he should resign for lying to Parliament.
Regardless of how any particular policy might be implemented, if we can actually talk about what particular policies might be applicable in the future, I mean, to Callum, to our Lib Dem in particular, given what you've just said, mm-hmm. I mean, the Lib Dems are often perceived as the party of localism, for instance, mm-hmm. and a common criticism of the CAP is that it is essentially a sort of corporate subsidy. So it attributes subsidies by acreage, which then very often pushes up the price of land and benefits those who own the largest chunks, and therefore small farmers are disadvantaged. I mean, would you foresee, I mean, you're nodding along with this, so would you therefore foresee any future equivalent cap doing something to combat this?
I mean, I think the European Union needs to reform the policy, and you'll be surprised how many Liberal Democrats do agree with that sentiment as well. It's not a you know, everybody. A lot of people think that we're quite a Europhilic party, and the bottom line is we have a lot of criticisms of the European Union. This happens to be one of them. And I think if the government's going to bring in a similar programme, it definitely needs to at least consider smaller farms and the fact that acreage doesn't necessarily mean production. You know, you can have 25 acres. God, what a lot of land. 25 acres, and you're not actually be doing anything, so I don't see why you should be getting those payments if you're not actually producing anything. It should be on levels of production, not on how much land you're holding, because I think that's...
Yeah, well, I think that's very fair, and as you started your statement there, that the EU need to reform this policy. There's a lot of things that within the EU that needed to be reformed, but the EU have failed to reform them. And that's probably many of the reasons why we have left.
Now we can take our own reforms
into our own hands and change this policy for the better, to benefit small farmers, or change it to make it fairer.
But then the question comes again, where's the money coming from? Because it's 55% of farm incomes. That's going to be billions. That's billions that we could be putting into the National Health Service.
Well, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, to hear a Conservative talking about this pot of money and they're going to give it to everybody when it's finite, and basically the Conservatives are cutting back on spending anyway. So post-Brexit, you will have so many different government departments and so many different areas of the economy all vying for this one pot of money. And I don't think it's going to be there. I think that there probably will be cuts in the subsidy because the government just won't be able to promise as much of the subsidy as it currently is now.
Super stuff. Right, we'll leave that topic get there. And again, I'm sure in future months and years, it's going to be something we're going to hear an awful lot more about. But we're going to turn to a topic which we've touched on slightly over the past few minutes, which is: should investing in sources of renewable energies, so such as tidal, solar power, zero carbon, and all the rest, take precedence over protecting the local wildlife in that area? I mean, that's a very specific question, but if you have any other points related to renewable energies, do throw them out there. Richard?
I'll start with this point I made slightly earlier as well, with that all energies have an environmental, have a negative effect environmentally. There's always an environmental cost, whether you're setting up a wind turbine in the middle of the ocean, or whether you're building a coal burning plant. So there always are negative impacts, and we just have to evaluate almost what is the least negative impact of various energies. And I think when you actually look at renewable energies, the environmental impact is often, well, the negative environmental impact is offset by the alternative. And that is, if you look at the fossil fuel alternatives, though the impact environmentally of those is so much greater in the negative sense that it is, that you do sometimes, you will have to prioritise renewable energies, even if it does sacrifice sometimes local wildlife, because the alternative will sacrifice a lot more of the local wildlife in a way.
Well, I agree with Richard. Didn't think I'd say that, but yes, they are better for the environment. They reduce our CO2 emissions and greenhouse gases, and obviously reduce global warming. I don't know if people saw yesterday the National Geographic put out a video of a polar bear, just like you could see that it was clearly malnourished and starving, kind of walking across this iceless plain. And that is the direct impact of human activity. We have caused that kind of situation to happen. And so there's got to be things like we have to invest in renewable technology so that we can get a grip on this. And as I said before, we can quite easily do it by putting solar panels on top of houses, businesses. We can solve this crisis now, or at least make steps towards...
I mean, it's nice to see we're all in agreement on something, actually. I mean, the issue we've got is you can step towards biomass, the use of biomass and biofuels, but the problem you've then got is you're using large amounts of water, and potentially it competes with the food supply. While renewable sources, what we're advocating, you know, wind power, hydroelectricity, all that kind of stuff, have the advantage of being able to conserve water, and obviously they produce lower, you know, CO2 emissions. We wouldn't be advocating them if they didn't. So I think that the benefits definitely outweigh the problems, but we also need to address the problems in the long term, because if we don't, we could be creating a bigger problem on a local level if we don't. And I think the government acknowledges that, whether it's Labour, Conservative, or hell, Lib Dem. I think all governments recognise the negatives that come away from it and make a clear assessment. And I think on renewable energy we have to. I don't think we've got much choice, because if we don't take action, it's like Jacob says, we've all seen the photos of polar bears in the Arctic struggling, yeah. and we need to be doing something about that. We can't be tiptoeing around this issue anymore.
No, no, yeah, Cameron's actually right there. And also, is the with the effects that renewable energies have generally, on, negative effects they have on the wildlife, these can often be mitigated a lot more easily than that of a an oil plant or whatever. But something I always like to bring up that Jacob said is, there's a lot of work that still needs to be done with renewables. That's definitely very true. And just sticking a solar panel on a house does not come near to the costs or the energy costs of running that household for even a day. So whilst there are renewable energy, definitely needs to be that invested in. We always have that realistic expectation of what renewable energies can deliver. Currently, they are not in the situation where they are the magic solution to our energy problem. But they definitely still need that investment, and they definitely still need to be prioritised where they can be.
My only issue is that it's odd to hear a Conservative sit there and say this, and then they fully privatised the Green Investment Bank in August 2017. We needed that foreign investment to actually get these renewable energy sources going, and yet the Conservatives have privatised one of the ways of actually producing this energy. And yet you were in government with us when you set up the Green Investment Bank. I don't understand why it's now being fully privatised. It clearly shows that the Lib Dems actually did do a lot in government, to be honest.
Well, what the Lib Dems did or did not do in
government... Tuition fees.
Not really... with the Conservative record on renewable energy, I think it shows more in the results of what we've seen. We've seen a decline in CO2 emissions in the UK over about 10 years, between 10 and 12%. So we are making huge steps of progress, and it's also with the way is making this progress affordable. Because as you were saying in the earlier debate, there is only a pot of money. Where does this money come from? You can't just assign X amount of...
Can you put a price on the planet? Can you put a price on the planet, though?
It's not the case of that, because the work is still being done. It's just whether we work with businesses much more closely to do that work, which we will need to anyway, because it is businesses which are probably some of the biggest polluters in the UK. So we need to work very closely with them. We need to get them on board, and we need to do that at the first principled level.
But I think, we still need to have sort of mass investment in these renewable technologies, and in particular on research in terms of making them more efficient and effective at the job. And actually, if, we kind of, as a collective, if we have more of these renewable energy sources, then together, Richard, it's obviously going to produce more energy, which in the longer term is going to be more sustainable.
Moving on, and I want to sort of relate this to our previous question with regards to subsidies, because obviously an awful lot of subsidies go to wind farms and all the rest. Now, I think it's about 50 million a year which goes to wind farm owners to actually switch them off when generation exceeds demand. Now, how do you sort of resolve that sort of thing? How do you make this industry sort of self-sufficient, as it were? Because clearly your points are valid in terms of saving the planet and all the rest, but how can you make this economically viable without sort of draining the consumer all the time?
I mean, we need to find a way of storing the power that's actually created from these renewable sources. I mean, God knows why we're not already looking into that. I presume we are to some degree, but if you, it's about preserving that energy for the long term as well. It's no good producing it and then shutting them off. That's just being wasteful. I think we need to find ways of actually keeping this energy stored. So in events where, perhaps renewable energy is not producing as much as it might be, we can use the energy that we've actually stored to offset the difference.
Obviously, I'm not an expert in, let's say, wind turbines, I think is the topic they've raised there. I imagine they were turned off after they were after production exceeded demand, because they have quite a short shelf life. They don't last all that long, and so if you're letting them run needlessly, and there isn't, that's because that's obviously the storage facilities for that.
This is why we need to be storing isn't it?
Yeah. A few huge of these battery sites across the UK, but yeah. It's more of a case of protecting the investment in the actual wind turbine itself than allowing them to run needlessly. I can sort of see some semblance of logic behind that, even though it may not seem on the headline or something.
And maybe look at something along the lines of Robin Hood Energy in Nottingham, which is something that the council has set up.
Can you enlighten us further? What is for the uninitiated, what is Robin Hood Energy?
It's a council-run, not-for-profit energy company which basically provides energy to people in Nottingham. Not-for-profit.
Right, super.
Yeah.
Right.
So that's reducing, obviously, fuel poverty, which is a really big issue, and also the excess energy is then sold on to businesses as well. So that can generate a profit for councils, which can then be reinvested back into public services and things like that.
Right, super. We'll move on. So next question, we're going to go nuclear very shortly, as it were. But my next question regards GM crops. I want to know whether you're a Prince Charles or not. So a specific question, would GM crops be a suitable way of both reducing food dependency on imports and mitigating the need for food banks, for instance? So what do we think about the viability of GM crops in the future, especially given that we've talked about sustainability, sort of energy security? What about food security? What do we think?
Well, I don't think that people go to food banks for the reasons that you outlined because of GM crops. I don't think that would solve it.
I'm not saying they are, but in terms of food security, in terms of more food for people, all the rest.
Well, people go to food banks because of poverty, so we can solve that already with the current situation that we're in. I think that the scientific community is kind of less sceptical on this than the public. The public seem to be a bit, oh, we don't want this, what effect is it going to have? But I think if it increases the crop yield and makes crops obviously healthier for people with a population that's growing, I think why shouldn't we do it? As long as it's safe, really.
Once again, I'll probably toe away a bit from the party line here, because as a scientist, I can't quite see what the problem is. The science seems sound. It's been trialled in the US, and they'll use... Spain is also a huge producer of GM crops. So when researching this question, I was a bit sort of dumbfounded as to what the major problems behind this are. I know there are a few concerns, but there are... with the issue about food banks, as Jacob read, this is a hugely complex issue in itself, and GM crops, whilst may have an effect of falling costs of food, I don't think that will be a factor in either really affecting the issue that much or solving the issue.
The science evidently shows that, that there's not really much of a problem here. This is public hysteria. We're used to it. But, in the United States, the introduction of GM technology the introduction of GM technology actually increased crop yields by 22%. So, the benefits are there for everybody. It's producing a much higher yield already. We can already see it. And when there's that scientific consensus there, I think it's the job of politicians to not only follow that consensus, but put the foot down and say, no, that this is the way... They should show some leadership on this issue, I think. There's a reason that there's genuine reasons why the public are sceptical. You're always going to come up against that, but it's about time that politicians actually, got a bit of bottle and put their foot down and actually say, this is the way we should.
Joe, you mentioned Prince Charles. What's his view on this?
Yeah,
well, I believe that he is. Is he not rather sceptical? I don't know.
That surprises me, actually.
Yeah.
Or he might be in favour. He's one or the other. On a sort of serious note, why do you think there is such sort of... Because you're all... It's sort of rare unanimity around the table. Why do you think there is such... I mean, you called it hysteria, Callum, but do you think it's just a simple lack of leadership?
Lack of leadership, lack of understanding. I mean, let's be honest, most members of the public haven't got time to sit here and research this. They've got jobs. They've got a life. And I understand why. We haven't got a life, but they haven't got the time to sit here and research the figures and everything. And particularly if you're from the older generation, you're not used to this kind of thing. It's something entirely out of the realm of possibility. Yeah.
More saying another point. There is generally a bit of always fear of new science.
Yes, there is.
As there is any time it's introduced, and the name of it, genetically modified. It definitely doesn't help the situation. It does put that sort of like a bit of that scary sort of angle onto it, and it's almost going to be a branding issue, is it?
This is the problem. Scientists are absolutely rubbish at spinning things.
Well, no, Richard's a scientist and he's pretty good at spin, so.
I don't know whether you should take that as a compliment or not, Richard. But anyway, we're going to go on to our final topic, which bears some relation to what we've talked about previously, which is that of nuclear energy, and especially in the context of Hinkley Point getting approval. So the question, how much should the UK be willing to invest in nuclear energy? By extension, how viable are projects like Hinkley Point?
The nuclear energy is generally split into two areas, fission and fusion. And now we're all probably familiar with nuclear energy as fission. And we've talked a lot about the limitations of fossil fuels and other renewable energy throughout this podcast, but fusion is sort of the holy grail of renewable energy. Has minimal minimal environmental impact. Huge amounts of energy can be generated from it. It's quite like the ESA is a holy grail, but it is incredibly difficult to do. But that is what the end game of energy generation is going to be. No amounts of solar power or wind turbines with all their replacements, all their costs, are ever going to be able to match nuclear fusion. But as I say, it's not ready yet, but the UK government and other governments around the world need to invest in nuclear fusion. And the UK government is doing this. Recently, there's been an £86 million investment into the largest nuclear fusion reactor in the world. The Conservative government is, again, allowing us to pioneer into these fields and science and technology, become leaders, once again, in STEM. And that's what really needs to happen. And that investment needs to be there, because that is the future.
Well, I think that there is a concern, obviously, with the national security stuff, and I think that that was the reason why Theresa May didn't immediately go ahead with the Hinkley C decision, because it was being built by France and China, I believe.
Yeah.
And there was some kind of concern that they could build a weakness within this infrastructure, which clearly is quite a dangerous thing if that... I don't believe that they would, but, I mean, there's potential for it. So I think that we have to, obviously, look at these issues. And personally, I don't think it's the right discussion. I would rather have, you know, renewable energy. I don't know if... Is nuclear renewable?
Well, it's renewable in many senses. Like, you're not going to, in essence, like, run out of it. But, I mean, it does produce... I'm not a nuclear physicist, so I'm going to right here. You do obviously produce. There are radioactive products at the end of it. They need to be disposed of properly. That can be very expensive.
Yeah.
With nuclear fusion, that isn't the same problem.
I was going to ask, because there was a BBC documentary on a while ago, which was quite controversial in that it documented the waste that nuclear energy, sort of produced, and how it was rather difficult to get rid of that securely. So with fusion energy, what you've just been talking about, is there not that outcome in terms of risk?
I mean, depending on what you're, not without going to the exact reactions, basically you're just adding hydrogen together, and probably your product is going to be water in a way, or again, without getting it all, another isotope. Well, again, I'm going to get slated in the sun.
I've got a quick question, though. Is it quite expensive to decommission? Because if we're moving in towards renewable energy, at some point you are going to say, well, this is a more expensive energy source, should we be closing it down? How expensive would it be on a short-term basis and a long-term basis?
Well, obviously, the startup costs for huge reactors, whatever they are, and decommissioning costs are more than just for wind farms or solar.
And is this the same with nuclear fusion as well?
Well, as I say, we haven't actually built a reactor which is commercially viable yet.
Yeah.
So there is still a lot of work that needs to be done, and that is why the research money has been putting in. But it is the answer in the way, because even if you will have obviously higher decommission costs and things like that, but you will have to have less of them, and you have to put them up less time. They will last for a lot longer.
Mm.
And even with the Hinkley Point C, that lasts for 60 years, where the average wind farm will last about 20, 25 years.
Mm.
So you are going to see it is, I say, the money, the capital needed up front, and the capital needed commission is going to need to be more, but you're going to have to pay this less often. It's more reliable money.
Mm.
And also, you're never going to really have that same negative effect on the environment, which you will with solar energy, say, because you've got to take huge tracts of land.
Well, I mean, hang on a minute. There is the potential for a massive catastrophe, as we saw in Fukushima.
It's happened twice in this country. The cases we've had in this country have been, I think there was a leak of uranium some point in the 1970s. We've had two cases. One was on, I don't know how the threat level system works, but you have a threat level of 2 and then from 1 to like 7, I think it is. And we've had a threat level of 2 and 5. And in particular, I don't know the exact cases, so I'm not going to sit here like I'm an expert, because I'm not.
I'm really not an expert either. But it's
just that this is something we do need to consider. I mean, if nuclear fusion, is a safer option than I think we should always consider all roads. I don't think we should ever rule anything out. I think it's bad governance to just rule things out.
But I
do think we need to be moving more towards renewable energy. But if this is a way of securing, you know, so some of that energy that won't be renewable for a long period. I mean, 60 years is a sizable period, to be honest.
Well, the point that you haven't touched on is the national security point of view, which is what Nick Timothy, who was the Prime Minister's advisor, he was quite concerned with this. So I wonder, you know, what are your thoughts on that?
As I understand it, we share a lot of our intel and military work. We work very closely with these people. These are not...
With China, I don't think...
You were talking about France, Germany before.
Yeah, yeah.
With China, obviously there's always different cases there, and it depends... how you can always manage that investment to see how that investment can be managed so there is not going to be that
national security risk there. Yeah,
exactly.
I mean, something I'd like to raise as well is the fact that the United Kingdom's actually notified the European Union that we're leaving EURATOM, the European Atomic Energy Community, and I was just wondering what your thoughts on that are personally. I mean, you don't have to leave it even if you're leaving the European Union, because Switzerland are actually a member of EURATOM as well. And I'm quite worried about the fact that we're leaving EURATOM, because it's quite pivotal to the way we run. I mean, if we're going to be moving towards nuclear fusion, surely it would be one of those cases where we do need to be remaining quite close to the European Union in our work.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I say defer to the experts, Joe.
Fair enough.
I don't know enough about it.
To say that we've been talking about United Kingdom's energy policy and nuclear energy and fracking as a bunch of students, I think that's gone, basically. But right, we're going to end there, folks. So thank you ever so much for all coming along. This podcast will be out very shortly. And... I'm sure you can all look forward to our January edition, which will be out following the Christmas break. But until then, it's goodbye from us.
Goodbye.
And thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.